Well, thank you. It's great to meet you this evening. Some of you I've met in other contexts, but most of you are new faces to me and bodies too. I mean, your entire self is new to me. And I'm looking forward to getting to know you a little bit. Some in the Gateway sessions, because I get three lecture shots at you, so to speak. And so I'm looking forward to meeting some of you in that context. But others of you, if we don't have an opportunity to get together, my office is on the third floor of Jennings Hall, up on the top. We have a suite in the Theology and Missions offices, and most of us are just really lonely. So if you'd come by and see us, it would help us feel more at home. Yeah, aww. So come see us. We'd love to get to know you, love to meet you. Dr. Barnard has really set a high standard here, not just tonight, but in the entire Gateway experience, and I hope that in some way I might be able to contribute a little bit to it. And I want to follow up on what he's been saying by taking us into the future just a little bit and picking up on some of the paradoxes of technology, and I'll explain what I mean as we go. You have an exciting future ahead of you. I know you've heard that before. It sounds like an address at a college or high school graduation, but it is true. And for some of you, the future is going to be like a roller coaster ride. It's going to be exhilarating and thrilling, and you're going to want to line up again and ride it all over again. For others of you, it's going to make you dizzy. It's going to make you sick to your stomach. And it's not entirely clear right now what the future looks like and what the trajectory is going to be that leads to one conclusion or the other. And that's why we're so interested in you thinking carefully and reflectively about the future. So if I can extend the metaphor a little bit, so you can choose carefully which ride you want to take. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the future and about the technology of the future. And about why technology doesn't always work. Sorry, about technology, but just by reminding you of the Christian meta-narrative, the meta-narrative, the story that is the Christian story that begins with God creating humanity, male and female, and giving them dominion, a stewardship kind of dominion over the earth. That means not only that human beings have been given the permission and, in fact, the command to order the world, the animal world and others, in such a way as to contribute to human flourishing, but also to contribute to the flourishing of the world, of nature. But also human beings have been given dominion to know and to steward the world around them, to be good stewards of the world around them. However, we're told in that Christian meta-narrative that there is a limit to knowledge, that there are certain things that Adam and Eve, for instance, were told they should not seek to understand. They should not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that they eat from that tree, they will die, is what God told them. And of course, you remember the story of the serpent who said, "Oh, you shall not surely die." God really is just kind of hold back some of the fruits, if you will, of his creation from you. You shall not surely die. And we know that the story goes on that they ate of that fruit, and therefore they were excluded from the Garden of Eden. Now, their dominion stewardship, their tending and caring for the world would involve pain and labor and a quest for survival. And so we find in those early chapters of Genesis the development of tools and other artifacts that are going to help in stewarding the environment that God has created, because it's tough. You don't just till the garden and tend to nature with your hands. You don't just dig in the dirt with your fingernails. You need tools and artifacts. And so the dominion mandate, the stewardship mandate, includes a mandate to be technologists. Human knowers, Homo sapiens, are also human makers, Homo faber. And so we are technologists by nature and by command. God commands us to exercise dominion, stewardship, and that's going to include the development of technologies. I don't have time to talk to you about the covenant renewal, but it's very important in our understanding about the role of human beings versus other created beings in the universe. But we'll maybe have another opportunity to talk a little bit about that. So we are, by nature and by command, technologists. And boy, have we obeyed the command. For example, we have developed electronic and digital technologies that now occupy the majority of our time. So that now the average American consumes about 150 hours of television and internet time. That's about 5.5 screen hours a day, or 10 years of your life to the time you're 50 years old. So by the time you're my age, you will have consumed, if you follow the pattern, 10 years in front of a little blue screen. Well, I'm sorry, a 60-inch LCD. You will have spent 10 years, imagine that, 10 years of your life in little increments, in short ball games, in American Idol, or whatever the television program du jour is. Notice this slide. Kaiser Family Foundation did a survey and found that among 8 to 18-year-olds, the amount of time spent with each medium, television, music, computers, video games, print, and movies, occupies media exposure of nearly 11 hours in a typical day. How many hours are you awake every day? What would you guess? 18? So that's 11 out of 18 hours. How many hours are you awake every day? About the same, about 18. So think about that. That amount of time in a given day spent in media exposure, that's a huge amount of our day. Now, as Dr. Barnard said, I'm not trying to convince you that's bad yet. I just want to tell you what the phenomena looks like. 11 hours of your day, 10 years of a 50-year lifespan. Notice this, and this keeps changing, of course, because to date, there are more than 187 billion text messages sent monthly in the United States about things like, I had a cup of coffee, she likes me, and all kinds of other things that we won't get into. But notice, I mean, well, we'll get into some of them next week when we talk about sex, but that's a whole different talk. Okay. I was lecturing one time in my ethics class, and we were talking about human sexuality, and my last words before we left, and I had no idea what I was saying. I mean, the words came out of my mouth before I understood what I was saying. I said, now next class period, we'll look at pornography. I didn't mean we would really look at pornography. I mean, we'd talk about it. So look, by the way, it was standing room only. But look, look at the numbers here. I mean, you can read that yourself. The monthly voice and text usage by age. And notice that top number, there are lots of early adopters. Those less than 18 account for the majority of use, especially of text. That's the people who got their first cell phone. And they text everything. I'm sitting down now. I'm standing up now. My hair is starting to curl. You know, all those things that we talk about. And, obviously, teens in general constitute the majority, but notice this bottom line, and I know that you've experienced this. People would rather text now than talk on the phone. Why? Anybody? It's quick. No, did you say no confrontation? No confrontation? You don't get distracted into some discussion that you didn't want to get into. You know what? You control. You control whether you answer the text or pay attention to the text. If you're on the phone with somebody, they control the conversation because, well, so far, you're too nice to hang up on them. So you get to control it. And so you want to do the texting, and you will decide whether you answer the text or not because, I mean, you just might be too busy to answer a text, right? So you let them know that they can get into your world by your permission because you get to control it. And notice this. This is staggering. Notice that as text messaging goes up among teens, face-to-face time goes down. And face-to-face time goes down by age, so that those who are 17 are spending less FaceTime with friends than they would when they were 15 years old. Because now we have Facebook friends. We don't have to have face-to-face friends because we have Facebook friends. And because we can now Twitter. I mean, Twitter. It sounds so innocuous, doesn't it? In fact, it sounds positively jovial and recreational. We Twitter. And I could tell you, in fact, I will. Listen to me now. This is my time to Twitter, not yours. I could tell you about a teacher in one state in the United States. You can Google, Bing, or otherwise search for it yourself. But one teacher in the United States who was a teacher of the year, who posted on his Facebook site a certain view about homosexuality. And he was, because he had been teacher of the year and because it was his Facebook site, he was charged with a violation of the separation of church and state and nearly lost his job. Now, here's what I want to say. This is a sidebar. This is not part of the lecture. Remember, my friends, that what you post on the internet stays there forever. Forever. Somebody will one day retrieve it if they want to. It may be someone on your opponent's campaign committee. It may be a potential boss. It may be a potential spouse. But somebody is going to retrieve the information that you put on the internet if you want it. There is a mark it down, have it tattooed on your person. There is no such thing as internet privacy. Not really. Not right now. And not in the near future. Facebook. Look at these numbers. I just grabbed these today. Facebook now has over 750 million active users. Almost one half of the U.S. population has a Facebook account. Except three of my friends that I cannot find. I've been looking for them and they don't yet have a Facebook account. And people spend over 700 billion minutes on Facebook a month and have at least 130 friends. Now, some of you right now are going, 130? Who has 130 friends? And others of you are going, oh, I had 130, you know, my first week on Facebook. But the average now, 130 friends. And notice I put friends in scare quotes because we all know, we all really know that these are not all friends. That we don't even know all the names of the people who are our Facebook friends. But we will celebrate their birthday because happily Facebook reminds us when their birthday is. And it makes it seem like we're intimate friends. Happy birthday, you. If you took the number of people on Facebook and put them end to end, they'd be better off. No, I'm sorry. Put them into N. If you put them together, Facebook is the third largest country in the world. And you don't even get to vote. The fun thing is, Dr. Barnard has reminded us that one of the things technology promises us is unfettered desire satisfaction. We get to have our desires met. And now some of the technologists are telling us, not just today, but forever. Look at what Ben Bova, the physician, says in his book Immortality. He says, physical immortality is within sight. The first immortal human beings are probably living among us today, and you might be one of them. There are men and women who may be able to live for centuries, perhaps even extend their lifespans indefinitely. For them, death will not be inevitable. So the project to extend human lifespan indefinitely, think about that. What's human lifespan now, roughly? Roughly 80 years, right? What if you could double it? 160 years. What if you could extend human lifespan to 400 years or 500 years? Or, as Dr. Bova says, extend it indefinitely. Well, I mean, we might think, well, who wouldn't want that, right? Well, my guess is that people who live in sub-Saharan Africa might not want another 80 years of the kind of lives they've been living. My suspicion also is that a lot of social structures would have to change if we had extended human lifespan. What would it mean to stand in the altar and say, till death us do part, if you're talking about 450 years? People want renewable contracts. I'm sorry, we already have those. I forgot. But notice Time Magazine's headline. Immortality by the year 2045. Now that's in your lifespan. How will it be achieved? Anybody read the Time Magazine? How will it be achieved? Through technology, through biotechnology. And the person up there on your right, the top person, is Ray Kurzweil, who is a philanthropist and scientist and inventor who believes that he is seeing the day in which, and living in the day in which computer speed and capacity and the capacity and speed of the human brain will merge and we'll have an entirely new species. And that's what he's talking about in his book, The Singularity Is Near. He says that by the year 2045, humans will merge with machines, we'll have a new species, and we can live forever. And guess what? Ray Kurzweil takes 250 supplements a day to ensure that he lives long enough to turn the immortality corner. So through those kinds of technologies, and Aubrey de Grey, in his book Ending Aging, suggests that there may be pharmacological ways to ensure our immortality, and he even gives a prize to those who make advances in immortality research, get this, called the Methuselah Prize. But why do we have to be human anyway? I mean, what's so good about being human? The transhumanist movement suggests that we are transitional humans on the way to something different called post-humanity. And so Nick Bostrom, the philosopher of the transhumanist movement, helps to co-edit a book on human enhancements. Let's not be limited by time and space and by gravity and by the finitude of our memory and the finitude of our IQ and the finitude of our aging bodies. Let's escape the body through the use of technologies. And James Hughes has already begun in his book Citizen Cyborg to explore the social and even legal implications of becoming post-human. How he asked, do we protect post-humans since there is no such thing as post human rights. They're just human rights, but no post-human rights. So how do we protect post-humans? And by the way, what about this part of the room over here who become post-human because you have access to the technology, just like right now you have access to, oh, I don't know, computers and medicine that people in the Southern Hemisphere don't have access to? What happens when you have access to those high-powered technologies and you can become post-human, but the rest of us are merely human? Have we stratified society even more? Now it's not just economic stratification, now it's technological and biotechnological stratification. Or the eugenicists who say, look, let's take this evolution story that Dr. Barner was telling us about, this naturalistic evolution story, let's take something that is slow and plodding and something that has taken millennia to work out, and with the technology, take it into our own hands. And now we can make better people through the use of technology. And so John Harris is a serious philosopher at Manchester University in England who argues in this book that we should take the power of evolution in our own hands and that we should develop superhumans or better humans through the use of these technologies, and we should develop a new plan that Nicholas Agar talks about, a new plan called liberal eugenics. The old eugenics that Hitler used was a state-mandated coercive eugenics. That's bad, but if everybody could do it their own way, could create their own future using these technologies, wouldn't it be wonderful? And we could become better human beings through technology. Now look what happened. Our mandate to use technology has now turned us, the technologist, into the technological artifact. Instead of using tools to construct the future, we use tools to reconstruct ourselves. And the technologist becomes the technology. Something subtle but profound has taken place. So Kevin Warwick, the robotics professor in Reading, England, says that he was born human as a mere accident. And he says, if we stick to our present physical form, we're pretty limited. But I want to become, he says, a cyborg. And so he has a chip implanted in his arm. And when he had that done, all it did was, like when he walked into his office, the lights turned on and the doors opened, his computer booted up. You know, big deal. When I walk into Kroger, all that happens. But his second chip was implanted in his wrist. And when he would manipulate his wrist, a robotic hand would be manipulated. And think about the use of that technology, say, for people who have injuries or who have paralysis. They could perhaps use that kind of technology to restore the use of those limbs. Then he had a chip implanted in his wife's wrist. Interestingly enough, the health authority in England would only allow that to be implanted for 24 hours. So not really long enough to test all of the effectiveness of it. But when he manipulated his hand, his wife felt the fingertips tingling in her hand. Now that technology could be really handy if you wanted to keep a spouse from shopping or something. You know, you could say, drop that. Or get one of those while you're at it. But imagine the ways those technologies could be used. In fact, I've had an opportunity to sit down with Kevin Warwick and talk to him about some of the ethical issues here, and he's like a kid with a new toy. He almost can't imagine anybody misusing this technology. which I can't imagine anyone not misusing technology, even, you know, good technologies, as it were. Well, I don't have time to tell you about Robo Sapiens, but remember, Homo sapiens are Homo faber, and maybe a new species coming down the pike called something like Robo Sapiens. Well, the times, they are a-changing, and my time is moving rapidly, so let me rush. But Baroness Greenfield in Oxford says, look, in ways that we could never have imagined, the technologies of the 21st century are challenging the most basic compartments by which we've made sense of our environment and lived as individuals in it. Information technology, nanotechnology, and biotechnology are blurring or even breaching every dichotomy that has until now transcended any particular culture and held firm for every human society. Like, it's bifurcating the real versus the unreal, the old versus the young, the self versus the outside world. And so she's pointing to these paradoxes of technology. On the one hand, it promises us good things. On the other hand, there could be deleterious, look that up sometime, deleterious results. So, for instance, in Sherry Turkle's new book, Alone Together, by the way, there's a paradox, Alone Together, she surveys a whole group of people, and she does an interview with somebody who says, look, you know, I kind of like this Second Life. Does anybody know what Second Life is? Second Life is a virtual environment where you can choose an avatar and you can live as that avatar. You can trade and buy and sell as that avatar. You have a totally separate virtual life. And so here's Pete, one of the persons in the interview, who says, you know, I really like Second Life as my preferred way of being with people. I want to just ask the question, is that really being with people? To be with an avatar. By the way, one of the cool things about Second Life is you can fly. And, you know, imagine that for getting across campus. You can fly on Second Life. But you see the problem. The personal, tell me your name.
Eric.
Shake my hand. Eric and I are now not just Facebook friends, although we're not Facebook friends, but I don't think. But you know, now we have an opportunity to develop a relationship because we've met one another face to face, incarnate, in bodily form. We now have an opportunity to get to know one another. But if I meet Eric's avatar on Second Life, I don't know whether it's really looks like Eric or not. I mean, the avatar may be ugly and malformed, unlike Eric. And I could choose an avatar that's svelte and fit, you know, about 7 foot tall, like I'm meant to be. So how do you know when you replace the personal with the virtual? How do you know one another? How do you develop a relationship with an avatar? Or, as we saw in Surrogates, and this is a scene from Surrogates, or these are images from Surrogates, the human might be replaced from the non-human. And Turkle interviews somebody who says this, I'd want from the robot a lot of what I want from a woman, but I think a robot would give me more in some ways. So you talk about e-harmony. He wants robot harmony. And with a woman, there are her needs to consider. That's the trouble I get into. If somebody loves me, they care about my ups and downs, and that's so much pressure. But if I had a robot, just like controlling my text messages, I could control not just my desires, but the robot desires. Now I'm the master not only of my world, but I'm also the master of the robot's world, and I can limit the pressures that the robot's going to feel and the pressures that the robot's going to put on me. I'd rather have, this Wesley is saying, he'd rather have robot love than human love. No. That's what every human being says. And the robots do not say that. The human is replaced by the non-human. And in this case, preferred to the non-human. Or maturity is replaced by emotional dependence. 20 years ago, says Terkel, as a practicing clinical psychologist, if I'd met a college junior who called her mother 15 times a day, checking in about what shoes to buy and what dress to wear, extolling a new kind of decaffeinated tea and complaining about the difficulty of a physics problem set, I would have thought her behavior problematic. I would have encouraged her to explore difficulties with separation. I would have assumed that these had to be addressed for her to proceed into successful adulthood. But these days, a college student who texts home 15 times a day is not unusual. So we're tethered, like in the Matrix, tethered by the technology. But wait a minute, the technology promises us freedom as long as you stay tethered. As long as you stay tethered. Well, the technology promises us at least efficiency. We can be more efficient. We can get a lot more done if we just have the technology. Do we want all of our relationships governed by technology? Or, governed by efficiency? Do we want every human relationship to be trumped by efficiency? My wife and I, last week, celebrated, I hate to tell you this because it dates me even more than my gray and my beard, but my wife and I celebrated last week 37 years of marriage. Thank you. Thank you. She should get the applause, I can guarantee you that. But look, it would not have been a happy anniversary gift for my wife to say to me over dinner, "You know, you're a really efficient husband." I'd either think she was criticizing me, meaning I don't spend enough time with her, or I wouldn't even know what she was saying because it's a category mistake. You don't gauge relationships on efficiency. No matter what we used to say about, well, you know, quality time's better than quantity time. Well, what about both? Let's have good quantity time and good quality time. Efficiency is what technology promises us, but we don't want everything governed by efficiency. The rest of the creation narrative, the Bible narrative, talks about the building, the technological construction of an artifact called the Tower of Babel, where humanity said, let's build ourselves a city and a tower and make a name for ourselves. Let us be in control of our relationships, our artifacts, our humanity, our future. And you know how that story turns out. God destroys Babel, scatters the people, and the story goes on. So I ask you, am I, unreflective adopters of technology? Are we, even if not in reality, are we in our minds and our emotions, are we standing in line around the Apple store the next time the new technology pops out, just bringing it into our lives without thinking about it? Are we, as churches, are we taking the next new technology and just making it a part of the church without thinking about what it means for our future? Are we unreflective adopters of technology? Quentin Schultz says that we are largely voracious consumers of cyber novelty. And we've naively convinced ourselves that all these innovations are going to automatically improve our society and make us better people regardless of how we use them. What I want us to do and what Dr. Barnard wants you to do is not to reject technology. After all, I'm using it. but to be a reflective adopter, to be a critiquer of technology in the best sense, to say, does this technology contribute to the form of life that is consistent with the Christian meta-narrative? Or does this technology erode the narrative and in fact alter our humanity in ways that make us less than human rather than post-human? Or another way to ask the question is, has the promise of unbounded freedom become bondage? And I've got a test for you to see if it's the case. Put away your cell phones, put away your text messaging for 2 days. See, you can't even imagine it. 2 days. Don't answer a text message, don't answer a phone except an emergency, and don't Facebook. 2 days. You know what will happen? Your heads will explode. I've tried it. I've tried to take a techno sabbatical. It's difficult. And the problem is, not everybody takes it with you, so they constantly want to know, why didn't you text me? Can I tell them your secret? Dr. Barnard's my hero, because he's a man who has never once in his life texted or received a text message. And most of us can't even remember what that was like. So, think about these things. Dr. Barnard, do we have time for questions? We have a few minutes, don't we?
We do.
And he has a roving technology, the microphone. So let's take a few questions for either me or Dr. Barnard.
Indeed. And if you do have a question, we're just going to take a few more minutes. So hang in there. Don't get stir crazy on me. We have a few more minutes. And some of you may have questions about the material that we have covered tonight. If you do, hold your hand up really high or stand. I will bring the mic to you so that we can get it on the recording. And then either Dr. Mitchell or I will answer your question. There is a question here. Hang on, I'm coming.
By the way, while he's doing that, as you're reading the material for Gateway, these questions are going to come back up. So you'll have opportunity to consider those. Yes, sir.
Okay. I have one question for you. What do you think about bioethics, specifically regarding nanotechnology and stem cell research?
Okay. Let me separate them, first of all. And I will say, first of all, about nanotechnology, there may well, in fact, be very, very good uses of nanotechnology, because nanotechnology, just using little molecular-sized tools and engines, could, for instance, be used to create a nanobot that would go in and clean out the arteries of a person who's got arterial sclerosis or some other medical problem. But here's a worry. One worry about nanotechnology is that we may be able to create, listen to the language here, self-replicating nanobots. So you make a tiny little robot, and it's able to make copies of itself, just like a cell makes copies of itself. What do you do if the nanobots get out of control? How do you reverse what you've created? So my answer to your question is, I think nanotechnology can have very good uses, but for certain uses of nanotechnology, before we kind of turn them loose, so to speak, we already need to have worked out how we're going to reverse any potential problem. I mean, it only makes sense that we should be considering worst case scenarios as we're developing the technology. about stem cells. One thing we need to know is that there are two kinds of stem cells. Just like you have two kinds of cells in your body, you have somatic cells. Look, these are somatic cells on my skin. When they reproduce, if they reproduce correctly, they produce more skin. I have liver cells. When they produce more liver cells. They never produce skin because they already have the instructions that they need to produce the kind of tissues that they came from. But the advantage to stem cells is that the stem cell hasn't yet received those instructions. And we might be able to program the stem cells to make the kind of tissues we need. So if somebody needs a liver transplant, we might be able to create new liver tissue using stem cells. But here's the problem. In order to get one form of stem cell, namely embryonic stem cells, you have to kill the embryo in the extraction process. So when you extract the stem cells, you kill embryos, human embryos. Now, if human embryos matter, if human embryos are protectable human life, then there's a moral problem with killing human embryos. Even, by the way, there's a moral problem with killing a human embryo even to save another life. Because did anybody know how many organs are how many people are on the organ waiting list on any given day needing organs? Somebody say? It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100,000 people are on the list today wanting organs, needing organs to live. Okay? Tell me your name. Becca, Lisa, Tiffany. Becca, Lisa, Tiffany. You know, we could kill Becca, Lisa, and Tiffany. May it never be. But and their organs could serve the needs of people who are going to die without them today. And after all, it's only three people to save hundreds of people. So my point is, if human embryos count, and this is a question we have to answer, we have to work through this question. If human embryos count, then killing them to get their cells is morally, at least morally, relevant to whether we would kill our friends here to distribute their organs. You would say, that's horrible. We would never do that, and we wouldn't. Well, why do we want to kill human embryos? We have to answer the question. It's a very important question. By the way, the other source of stem cells is from a patient's own body, and we can also create stem cells without having to kill anybody. So that's the kind of stem cell research I would favor, not embryonic stem cell research.
We have time for one more question. Here it is.
Along the lines of abortion, in this techno-utopian society, do you think with all the mutated humans, do you think there would be a need for abortion? Do you think it would solve that issue?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. If you saw the New York Times Magazine from about 2 weeks ago, there was a story about a woman who now listen to this now, a woman who used reproductive technologies to get pregnant. So here's a woman who wants to get pregnant. She found out she had twins. She was carrying twins. And she said, this is her language, you can check it out. Her language was, if I had had these twins, if I had conceived these twins naturally, I would have had a problem aborting one of them. But because they were developed through technology, I didn't have moral qualms about aborting one of them. And so she selectively reduced one of the twins. And the justification was, I created them, they were my handiwork, and therefore I don't have a moral problem with getting rid of them. So similarly, I think, I don't see any reason why this unfettered desire for control wouldn't continue to exercise itself in the form of abortion. But listen, here's the other thing. You may live to see the day when babies are not gestated in the body anymore. There's a literature about artificial uteruses where one day you can have the eggs fertilized with the sperm. That's next week's talk. You can have the eggs fertilized with the sperm in the petri dish and transfer the embryos to an artificial uterus in a clinic somewhere. Now, listen to me. People will stand in line for this technology because it means that husband and wife can go on working all the way through pregnancy because, well, there is no pregnancy. And you just go by the clinic every evening and look in the little glass tube and say, "Hi, Junior," and tap on the tube and say, "My baby's developing." And it's all clean and simple and there's no pain in childbirth. It's technology to the rescue, right? But I ask you again, is that the human meta-narrative or is that something else? And you will have to answer the question, in your generation, is that the human meta-narrative or is that something else?